From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the year 2062, where there are flying cars, tubes that transport you from your kitchen to your garage, machines that move your dirty dishes with the push of a button. That is day-to-day life for families like the Jetsons. Yes, I'm talking about George Jetson, his boy Elroy, daughter Judy, and Jane, his wife, from the famed cartoon The Jetsons. The show first aired in prime time in 1962. It was set to take place 100 years in the future, and that's now just 40 years away. Maybe you've seen some of the memes in the last few days about George Jetson's birthday. According to pop culture lore, George was born this past Sunday, July 31st, 2022. Happy birthday, baby George. Needless to say, the future that the creators of the Jetsons predicted isn't exactly what we're seeing now or what we anticipate seeing decades from now, but some aspects of the show did come to fruition. We don't have flying cars, but we do have video calls. We've got watches that can talk and play video. But as media scholars say, the show was more than just a silly cartoon with a bunch of gadgets. And as Matt Novak wrote for the Smithsonian in 2012, the show, quote, stands as the single most important piece of 20th century futurism, end quote. He says that the first season of the show helped define the future and opinions of it for many Americans. This hour, we discuss what the Jetsons got right, what's too far-fetched, and what could be in the realm of future possibilities. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Dr. Roger Dubey is with us. Roger is an experimental physicist, professor emeritus, and research professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and the driver of a self-driving car. Roger, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. I knew you would bring that up somehow.
Well, you know, look, you're like a Jetson, except for you're a Dubey.
Yeah.
Welcome,
right.
Sir. And welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Great to have you. And welcome to Bob Thompson, trustee professor and director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Don't you want to include that I drive a 1996 Subaru?
You're like the anti-futurist.
I'm the Flintstones.
You are the Flintstones. Bob is the Flintstone, and Roger is a Jetson. So that's where we are. But in 1962, this comes out, and I was surprised to find out this week, Bob, that that the Jetsons, initially, it launches in 62, and it really only lasts a year, and then it came back in the 1980s. And some of the analysis, the post-analysis there, is it debuted in color as the first color program on ABC, but many of the TV sets at the time did not have color, and it just didn't pop the same way. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's true. Color gets developed by NBC way back in the 1950s. They start putting color shows on, but nobody is buying a color TV. We got as far as, I think it was a 64, 65 season where less than 5% of people had yet had a color TV. So it's true, Jetsons was this broadcast on ABC in color, but very few people would have seen it that way. And it is also, I'm glad you reminded us, that we think now of Jetsons as this kind of long-running television cultural phenomenon. But like a couple of other famous shows, The Honeymooners, it only went one season until it was then redone way much later in the 1980s, where its predictive value was less interesting. So the original Jetsons, we're talking about 24 episodes of about 24 minutes apiece.
Yeah, and it is a piece of its time. I went back and watched some of the clips, and I was struck by the scene, Bob, where George is talking to a colleague who's single and never has anything good to eat, and George says, "What you need to do is get a wife who can cook you those meals." And I'm going, "Yeah, I don't really." That was not predicting the future nearly as well enough when it comes to the popular culture and, I guess gender equality changing. Even the intro has Jane grabbing his entire wallet when he offered her, a dollar, and she grabs the whole wallet and then heads off to go shopping. Not exactly at the forefront of the future when it came to gender equality, Bob.
Yeah, and forget just gender equality. Let's let that pass for a minute. But that opening itself, he drops off his daughter Judy, and she is carrying ye olden days books, actual books with bindings and stuff like that. As you point out, not only is it a gender faux pas, but George is offering Jane currency. It's actually, you know, dollar bills they appear to. Forget this predicting crypto. It doesn't even predict the credit card at this point. And she's going to go off shopping in, like, physical space. We're 40 years from 2062, and we don't do that anymore. But my favorite part at the to the closing credits, George gets home, and I think it's Jane offers him a pipe, which and a pipe that you actually light and smoke comes out. So again, no vaping here. And not only is he smoking, but he's smoking a pipe, which is more 19th century than 22nd.
Well. You know, it was still a product of its creators, who might have been limited in certain ways. And the even credit cards did exist in 1962, although they weren't, you know, sort of dominating the stage of how business gets done the way they would be in future
decades.
But they
were around. You're right.
Yeah, they were around enough that maybe the creators could have figured that part out. On the tech side, Roger Doobie, they seemed obsessed with flying cars. Now, self-driving is different than a flying car. Are we still obsessed with the notion of flying cars, or are we giving up that ghost, Roger?
There is still a segment of society that's very focused on flying cars. It's kind of like a little niche of the customer market that is still keen on that technology. The idea, of course, that makes it appealing is that you free yourself from being limited to two dimensions, and now you can move in three. The implementation of that in a reasonable way is difficult because you have, you know, all of the issues of air traffic control, who gets to go where. Somehow you can't put lines in 3D space to define lanes. This all has to be done in a different way. And so there are a variety of issues that would immediately appear from an implementation point of view, not even to mention what technology are you going to use to propel these vehicles up into the air, and are they going to be polluting in some way?
In my mind, Roger, this is where Roger and I may disagree a bit here, but in my mind, the show comes out in 1962. They're looking 100 years in the future. They're thinking self-driving cars is kind of the cool futuristic way of how we're going to get around. In my mind, the reality of transportation has gotten worse than 1962 because what we don't have, forget flying cars, that's a silly idea. What we don't have is high-speed transport everywhere that is relatively clean energy, efficient, publicly serving in a more egalitarian way. We don't have that in this country. I feel like 60 years later, we are just as addicted to the automobile. We're not very creative. Everything is clunky and expensive that we try anything new. Now, maybe you disagree because you think the technology of self-driving and whatnot is going to take us in a better direction. I don't know if I'm there yet. What do you think?
Well, so yes, I would argue that we're not there yet, but the combination of self-driving technology with the internet and the continual connectivity of these self-driving cars. For example, the Teslas communicate pretty much continuously with the mothership. They always can go back and look at where your car was, how fast it was going, et cetera. They have an awareness of what their fleet is doing. That information could be used to enable cars that are on the road to talk to one another, to say, you know, hey, there's a traffic jam that's forming up ahead. You know, let's take 20 of our cars and we'll shunt you off to some side street to reduce the pressure on this main avenue. And so you can now begin to envision adding some intelligence to the fleet, to the cars, so that they actually properly anticipate what's going on and react to it. We have that a little bit in GPS because we do have that traffic awareness capability. But typically that requires some degree of interaction from the driver, unless you have a self-driving car, in which case it takes care of it for you. So we've got possibilities. I think the addictive quality of being able to go where you want, when you want, is very high. And I think that's what keeps people wed to the concept of having a car or some sort of vehicle that they control, because they can just get up and go as opposed to standing around waiting for some scheduled mass transit. The impact on the environment is a whole other issue that I certainly agree needs to be addressed. But I think that's the core problem that keeps us really beholden to cars.
Yeah. So one more point on this, Roger. I was going to say, when I thought about this conversation this week, I was going to say something along the lines of, let's look 60 or even 100 years in the future and assume there's no nuclear winter and no climate catastrophe, et cetera. And I was going to be sort of cynical. But you know what? It's been a hard week for cynics. The climate bill that looks like it's going to pass this weekend, with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema getting on board. I was with a friend last night who has worked both in Washington and in New York State in climate action for years. And she said that there is more actual optimism than there has ever been in this space, that this bill, while not perfect, is unbelievably better than anything that Washington has put forward. And that there was almost a feeling of popping champagne corks. There's a better jobs report today than expected. And there's a veterans health care bill that got done. I mean, it's been a hard week for cynics. So let's conclude the week on a note that says it's a hard week for cynics. And let's look ahead confidently and say that in 60 to 100 years, the world will have not broken down. And that we are finding a way to forge ahead here. And let's ask this question, Roger. What in 100 years from now, what is a realistic futurist think about the way we get around and what that starts to look like?
Okay, so we should really move beyond just transportation and kind of look at the entire environment, I think. And I have my very limited perspective of what I think the future might hold. So I am not the expert on this. I'm not the futurist that ideally you'd want to get on the show at some point. But, as, a physicist and as a person that deals with kind of leading edge technologies in a variety of different application fields, yeah, sure, I've thought about these things. The point that underlines all of this that maybe we can come back to later is that the process of envisioning good things is really important. You want to envision a positive future, one where there's harmony with the climate, harmony with other people. When you have this positive outlook, you can get excited about things like, should we go to Mars? Should we set a colony up on the moon? What would we gain from that? And so on. So I think the idea of being optimistic is really important for futurists. I have issues with those that tend to write, science fiction books that are talking about a variety of different holocausts that have occurred, environmental, nuclear, et cetera, zombies, and so on, because they really kind of take the fun out of things. You don't get to really sit back and daydream. They're setting a tone that says, things are going to get really, really bad. And I have a problem with that. It robs me of my excitement about what things are coming. And so this news that we just got this week is another example of, it's really important to be working on positive things. And when they occur, we want to relish those accomplishments. So that's a long intro to the kind of things that you asked me to talk about. I have a good friend who was a graduate student with me at Princeton who said that his goal in life was to create a 3D transporter, like in Star Trek. He said, that's the way we should be traveling from point A to point B. We shouldn't be getting on planes and so on. We don't have that yet. But, the point that I'd like to make is that a positively toned science fiction story, namely Star Trek, created this vision that allowed somebody to say, wow, we really should have that. And maybe I should work on the problems that are encountered and preventing us from getting to that possibility. Time travel, another example. We don't have that. We don't know if it's possible. I mean, from a physics point of view, we know the conditions that would allow one to travel through time. But the ones that we found are very, very particular and not easy to recreate here on Earth. But I think time travel is one of those tantalizing things. The theory of multiverses, another very tantalizing thing that allows you to daydream about what things could be like. A benevolent AI is another thing that I think is you know, exciting. Something, imagine a truly expansive intelligence that works for the betterment of humans across the planet, helping us achieve some of these goals. All of these things are, you know, things that we could envision and see, and we can begin to address the problems that are preventing us from achieving those things. But we want to have a positive outlook on that. And there is where we run into some issues.
Well, boy, you've given me so much to work with there, Roger, because I want to talk about time travel. I want to talk about beam me up, Scotty. And I do want to ask, we're going to get to the question of whether Megan Mac Rosie was the house cleaner for the Jetsons, the robot. I don't know if Rosie was actually just a Roomba that could talk or was like benevolent AI. So we're going to get there. But why, Bob Thompson, do shows that focus on the future and that attempt to kind of spark our imagination to look forward, why do they work? Why does a show like the Jetsons work?
Well, first of all, I think that last comment was a really important one about these optimistic visions versus pessimistic visions. And I think Star Trek is a great example. And that was almost contemporary with the Jetsons. Jetsons starts in, 62, Star Trek in 66. And Star Trek really does have this optimism of the future, that we've somehow managed these pacts with others. Even the bridge of the Starship Enterprise was this integrated racially and by gender and all the rest of it. We just lost Nichelle Nichols, one of the actors on that bridge. So in some ways, I think Star Trek was very much this much more visionary idea of a more utopian future. The Jetsons, on the other hand, was not. The Jetsons was the idea of presenting a good old-fashioned American idea of individualized life on a kind of suburban model, which included, of course, inefficient transportation and all that kind of thing. The Jetsons not only has people still having individual cars, they may be flying, but they're still individual cars, but then each one of them has their individual drone that delivers them from that car to their specific destination of beauty parlor or school or whatever. And then when we see what life is in this 2062, it's still racially monolithic. It's the old nuclear family. You've already talked about the old gender ideas. It's the idea that the very vision of America that we've been seeing in Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver was just going to happen. It was just going to be with flying cars.
Yeah, and when it comes to the way we think about the future, I think there's a difference between what Roger and what Bob are kind of talking about. Roger is talking about the functional value of optimism. The actual product of optimism can be real progress here. Envisioning good things for the future and working toward those, Roger is saying, actually leads to progress. Being cynical or negative all the time closes doors on possible innovation that can do a lot to save human life and this planet. The difference is, on the entertainment side, we don't have to be as optimistic because, Bob, I'm looking at the modern ways of looking at the future, movies like Bird Box, iRobot. There's an HBO show that I did not see called Station 11 that was about a pandemic. And I didn't watch because it was a little too close to our pandemic. It's not about COVID. It's about a much more serious pandemic. COVID's very serious. Nobody hear me say it's not. But we're talking about, you know, true societal devastation in Station 11. Why do shows like that work when they are so dark, Bob?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, when you've got horrible things happening, you can use all the special effects. Stuff can blow up. I mean, there is a basic dramatic value of apocalypse that you don't get in a sort of a nice future. There's something about optimism that makes us think more My Little Pony than it does all of the action we can see of cities collapsing and tidal waves hitting the Manhattan and all of that kind of thing. So part of it is that it's just it sounds terrible, but it's more exciting to see that. On the other hand, I think there's also, and I very much agree with Dr. Roger that we do want to envision, if we're going to have good things happen, we've got to at least be able to have a vision of what they are. I think some of the pessimism, though, and one of the reasons these connect to audiences in all the things you just listed and lots more, is the idea that as one sees the way we make choices, how we continue to live, the stubborn ways in which we don't want to give up a number of things that are going to make those optimistic futures not possible, that these movies in some ways are hortatory tales. They're warnings of futures that seem to be less and less further away. And I guess that gets into the whole idea of the excitement of being scared. Watching a dystopian futuristic television show or movie is not that much different than going on a really exciting roller coaster. It's fun to be scared to death when we're not actually literally facing it at that very moment.
Well, and it kind of dovetails with my confusion about why people like horror movies. I can't do it, Bob. I don't understand, Professor Thompson, why people want to watch, you know, these, look at the body count of this movie. Oh, it's almost Halloween movie season. Like, no, I don't need that. So I get part of why people say they like it is they can be scared, it can be exciting, but then it's over and their normal life is back. And it's a total contrast to normal life. It's not real. They know it's not real. And maybe those dystopian futures are a nudge for us to think about things, but we still have the comfort of our own life. Maybe it's kind of like a cousin of horror movies in that way, Bob.
Right. I think it's very much a cousin. It may be a sibling. There is that pleasure. It's that this could be coming, this may happen, but the pleasure in the end, as you point out, that it hasn't happened yet. And then, of course, there's always that hope that, of course, maybe it won't. This could never happen here and all of that kind of thing. But with a couple of exceptions, you talked about some of the headlines of the last couple of days. But for every one of those optimistic headlines, how many reports do we get from how many international scientific communities for how long about, predictions of let's just stick with the environment as opposed to.
I was trying to be optimistic here, Bob.
and I appreciate that, but I'm just saying, I think one of the reasons that back in the Jetsons we had this optimistic-like future, even though it was an optimism based on things that are the part of the problem, and that low these decades later, we've got more pessimistic stuff, I think is in many ways kind of following the leads of what people are seeing happening around them.
Yeah,
right now where I'm sitting, it's about 100 degrees.
Yeah. I know. I'm trying to end the week on an up note a little bit. By the way, John writes to say, Evan, I never realized till you played that intro that the Jetsons theme is closely echoed by the Simpsons theme. Shows are so parallel. You agree with that, Bob?
Oh, not only do I agree with it, but this is where I think the Jetsons was better at predicting the future than anything else, or was more ahead of its time, in that both the Jetsons and the Flintstones that started in 1960 were prime time animated shows, which means they were meant for not just kids on Saturday morning, which is where most animation in this country was done back then, but it was also meant for adults. We know this because Winston Cigarettes sponsored the Flintstones, and Fred and Barney smoked animated Winston Cigarettes in some of the commercials. And in that sense, now, of course, and Simpsons really broke this through. Simpsons opened up the door to Beavis and Butthead and Family Guy and all of those other shows. And now, of course, some of our most thought-provoking programming of the last 20 years has been adult animation, from BoJack Horseman to The Big Mouth and everything. And I guess we've got to give Hanna-Barbera and both the sister shows, Flintstones and The Jeffersons, a little bit of credit
for... The Jetsons, not The Jeffersons. The Jetsons.
I was saying The Jetsons. Oh, yeah, that was an interesting slip. But both the Flintstones and The Jetsons, sorry, a little bit of credit for making executives and creators realize that maybe animation is not just in big feature, you know, Snow White, Pinocchio, Bambi kind of things, or the kind of things that play just in Saturday morning in that kind of childhood programming ghetto. Even though both the Flintstones and the Jetsons ended up playing on Saturday morning, my whole experience of those shows was on Saturday morning, not on primetime. I wasn't old enough.
They were primetime debut shows. Isn't that amazing? When we come back from our only break of the hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the themes that Roger Doobie brought up about, you know, AI, benevolent AI, beam me up in the future as we do our own sort of looking ahead the way Hanna-Barbera did in 1962, 60 years ago when The Jetsons was created, envisioning a future 100 years in the future when George Jetson was a 40-year-old. That means his birthday was this past Sunday, as in the day of his birth, July 31st, 2022. Welcome to the world, George Jetson. David writes to me to say, by the way, Evan, Station 11 isn't as you described. While it's a post-apocalyptic world, you don't see what goes wrong. You see the human spirit enduring after the fact among those who survive with a minimal amount of violence, particularly when a single marauder invades a high-rise apartment in Chicago. It's not one of those action-crazy, violent shows, but a drama about the human spirit. That is from David. So Station 11, maybe a little more optimistic than I had feared. Maybe I've got to open the door to that one. We're going to come right back with Roger Doobie and Bob Thompson. Roger is an experimental physicist, professor emeritus, and research professor at RIT. And Bob is a legend in the field of understanding media and entertainment. He's a trustee professor and director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, what do you do with the old space left behind by Xerox, Kodak, Bausch & Lomb? Well, a new collaborative office space is opening in Innovation Square. That's the former Xerox Tower. Serendipity Labs is new to Rochester. We're going to talk about utilizing the big three old space. Then in our second hour, another collection of people and organizations making positive change in our community. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Yes, the Jetsons debuted in primetime, the Flintstones too. As Bob Thompson mentioned, they moved to Saturday mornings eventually, but yeah, those were, and they're not even listed as cartoons. They're technically, Bob, known as sitcoms, right?
That's correct. And here's one of my favorite observations. Both the Flintstones and the Jetsons had laugh tracks.
Yeah.
Now, what I find so funny about that is trying to imagine, so did they actually draw the crowd that's laughing in the background? Is it an animated crowd? Is it a human crowd? The idea of people up in space in the Jetsons and somewhere there are people laughing, I always find quite amusing. But you will totally not notice it when you watch it, because as a sitcom, you expect people to be laughing. That was the form.
There it is. Rob Braden, Megan Mack, all over it.
Kudos to your production team.
They're the best. They're the best. In fact, you know what, Rob? I'm funnier than you give me credit for, and you never give me a laugh. There you go. Roger Doobie, Rosie, the cleaning robot. Is that just a Roomba that could talk on the Jetsons, or was that a form of benevolent AI?
So. It kind of bridges a couple of things. It works on the basic assumption that we at that time believed that robots should be made in human form, that somehow there's something really good about having the human form that lets you do things. Now, granted, she rolled around on wheels, so it wasn't completely right, but they certainly started with that template. And there's a discussion on the side just about that. Intellectually, Rosie did not demonstrate a ton of prowess, but she did come across as a family member with feelings, with a role that was recognized by others. And in a sense, we have been moving as a worldwide community, moving very rapidly toward the development of artificial intelligence that has all of those qualities that we have it within ourselves, in our minds, without having a material body upon which to call for memories and senses of touch and smell. So it's a creation that will have a very different life experience than what we have. And there are reasons to be concerned about the way that's going.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and important point, because the current iterations of robot technology that are more like Rosie are companies like Boston Mechanics. Once in a while, mm-hmm. will release videos showing you what they look more like sort of big lanky dogs moving around, and
right.
Those videos frighten the heck out of me because they are more and more adept at moving around quickly, and I don't like it. But what Roger is talking about is getting away from the forms of animals or humans and just understanding what AI is capable of. And are you an AI optimist or a pessimist overall, Roger?
I actually sort of span both worlds. I use AI in my research. The AI that I use is one that basically allows me to absorb and interpret information, vast amount of information, much more quickly than I would be able to do as a person, or even with a fleet of grad students studying something that would be able to do as a group. This can be done much, much more quickly. So it's a very useful technology in that sense. That said, AI has some pretty harsh critics, and I personally have my own misgivings about some of its directions. In particular, the way that the AI absorbs and interprets information is something that they basically have the electronic equivalent of a mind or a brain, and they build and reinforce and destroy neural network pathways between neurons within that electronic brain to develop a picture that explains what they're being presented with. So they're learning just like we learn. You know, when we learn about when a child learns about water and they put their hand in the water, they begin to develop some understanding of what this thing really is. And that's what the AI does. The problem is that information, once it's been encoded into the brain of an AI, cannot be reversed. We can't simply turn it into an equation and say, oh, it's clearly calculating the following functions and coming up with an answer. It's a black box. And a lot of people in the scientific and engineering communities have misgivings about these black boxes because they don't know what's going on. Let me give you a quick and somewhat spooky example. A few years ago, a couple of AIs had been built, and the researchers thought, wouldn't it be interesting to connect these two AIs together and give them a pathway so that they could communicate with each other as they learn some information that's being presented. They did that, and the AIs developed along this communication pathway a language of their own that we to this day have not been able to decipher. That gives me a chill. It's like, oh my God, these things are able to do things that we can't even figure out, and these are our own creations. Things get much, much worse than that as you get into the present day. We've got AIs that are far more powerful than this simple example, And these AIs, there's a lot of discussion in the scientific community now about whether or not they have sentience, whether or not they are self-aware, and how would we determine that they are or not. And furthermore, if they are, if they become self-aware, what does this mean? Does this mean we can't turn them off at the end of the day because they're self-aware and it's going to be effectively killing them for the night? You know, there are all sorts of ethical things that suddenly appear because you've got a creature whose existence relies upon the presence of all of these electronic components and electricity, and yet there are these humans who have their hand on a button and can turn things on and off. What is our responsibility there? Those are all good ethical questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, and if their self-awareness and their knowledge acquisition allows them to build in fail-safes to prevent them from being shut down. I mean, my feeling on AI is generally that there's a large risk reward here, and the risk is enormous. And we've got to really try to stay ahead of understanding the monster you're creating in the lab before it gets out on its own. There's a lot of good that can come of it. There's potentially a lot of medical good and a lot of innovative good that could come out of it. But I think we have to be very careful. And it's that reason, Roger. I'm curious because I'm a very lay person when it comes to science and technology. But everything that you just described is the reason that I think it is almost fruitless to even try to predict what the future looks like in 100 years. Because in 1962, when Hanna-Barbera was rolling out the Jetsons, they could look 100 years in the future, and it was somewhat whimsical, and they missed the mark on a lot of things. But as the New York Post recently pointed out, I mean, there was a lot that they did hit correctly. Video phones, yes. Right. Flat screen TVs, cameras that can look inside your bodies, drones in the sky. You can call it Roombas, sure. And then there were things like 3D food printers, not quite, but almost, a smart oven, electric toothbrushes, jetpacks, self-driving cars, not flying cars. I mean, they were close on a lot of stuff that would be at least 60, but maybe 100 years in the future. The rate of technological advance now is so, the curve is so steep and the possibilities are so broad that I don't know that anybody could come close if you wanted to guess 100 years, let alone 60 in the future. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. These AIs, for example, are approaching a point that's referred to as the singularity. It's a point where the intelligence of an artificial intelligence system exceeds consistently the intelligence and intellectual ability of a human. That's called the singularity. The reason it's called a singularity is because once that happens, someone is going to get the idea, well, gee, we should ask the AI to redesign itself so that it's more efficient and more powerful. And the AI will promptly do so, or can. And in the same way that we can't decipher a simple language between two AIs, we are not going to have a ghost of a clue what they did to redesign themselves, or how they did it, or how to fix it or control it. And so there are a whole bunch of ethical issues that immediately show up that compound this question of what do we as the creators of these AIs, what is our responsibility to them? If you think of them as being sentient beings, what is our responsibility to us as humans across the world? And all of that are very deep and very disturbing questions. I just want to bring up one more piece of information, Evan. I can hear you have a question, but
no, go ahead.
In 1942, one of the most prolific and famous futurists, Isaac Asimov, wrote in a novel what are called the Three Laws of Robotics. He envisioned the issues that we're talking about today, and he created what he saw were ways to control this. The first law of robotics says a robot cannot injure a human either directly or by inaction. I'm paraphrasing here just to make it brief. The second law says the robots have to obey humans except where they violate rule number one. And the third rule is they have to protect themselves and their existence as long as it doesn't violate rules one and two above. So he developed this this heuristic set of laws upon which most of the science fiction that's been written dealing with robots use these three laws. And so the question then becomes, is it even possible for us to embed these laws into an AI? Don't know. And by the way, you know, the race for this superintelligence is not limited to the United States. I think this is a global race. You can think of some large national players that are working very hard at developing their own version of these technologies, because the feeling is that these intellects, these artificial intelligences, will be able to design super weapons that are far better than anything we can design.
All right, so
obviously,
what you're saying,
you need
is
the laws of robotics to stop that from happening. Go ahead.
What you're saying is, just we should all drink our best bottles of wine now. Don't hold them. There you go, Rob. See, we had to lighten it up. We had to lighten it up. It was getting too dark. Even though, realistically, I think these are very important questions, and we've tackled them numerous times on this program, and we will continue to until the robots tell us we are no longer allowed to, because that's important. So the reason we're having this conversation this hour, if you're just joining us, we're looking ahead. We're doing our own sort of futurism, and we're talking about why a show like The Jetsons was so popular. It debuted 60 years ago, and according to the show, George Jetson himself was born on July 31st, 2022. That was this past Sunday. So he was born Sunday, I guess 40 years in the future is when the show was set. And let me get some more listener feedback. We'll get back on a lighter track here.
Okay, good.
David says, by the way, lots of shows good for both adults and kids. Don't forget Rocky and Bullwinkle, exceptionally good cartoon aimed at both adults and kids. That leads me to two questions, Bob Thompson. Was The Jetsons a kid show or an adult show? And do you agree that Rocky and Bullwinkle, good for both adults and kids?
Second question first, yes. Rocky and Bullwinkle was an absolutely brilliant send-up of Cold War politics. The femme fatale was named Natasha Fatale. Boris Badenoff, names don't get much better than that. And the older you get, the better that show gets, which brings me to the answer to your question, your first question. Yes, it was for both adults and kids. Like all network television, it had to appeal to everybody. And when I was watching The Jetsons as a kids, and the same with Bullwinkle and Rocky, I got certain things out of it. And when I watched it as an adult, I got other things out of it. By the way, I hope you can still hear me, but during that last conversation, I've gone down into my panic room. I'm not sure how the cell reception is there. But getting back to robots, Rosie the Riveter is an interesting...
there you go. That's
wow.
a sad trombone.
Public radio, no less. Rosie the Riveter Rosie the Robot always reminded me of Rosie the Riveter. And that would have not been that far in the past when we had that. And of course, Rosie the Robot literally has rivets. That's how she's put together. But the question of is she AI or is she a robot? I always thought she was kind of an exploited proletariat, just really biding her time until the revolution. And we had plenty of those because we had, you know, Hazel, the maids on Jack Benny and the Danny Thomas show, Beulah. I mean, a whole string of these kinds of things, not to mention those in movies like Gone with the Wind. And then, of course, we had, I'm trying to think, Forbidden Planet was 1956. That had Robbie the Robot. Lost in Space would be after The Jetsons, interestingly enough. That came in about 65. Those were all robots. And then I guess the really scary AI was, 1968 with HAL in 2001,
yes.
A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes. No question about that. Another listener writes and says, Evan, if a laugh track is the standard for which one defines a sitcom, does Scooby-Doo also count as a sitcom and not a cartoon? So Scooby-Doo had a laugh track too? Yeah? Yeah? Bob Thompson, yeah. Scooby-Doo, yeah, I guess, also.
Yeah, I think it did. A sitcom is however you happen to be defining at any given time.
Not just about the laughter.
Got to have an audience, or whatever. But I would say Scooby-Doo less so, because the sitcom generally takes place in interiors. Oftentimes, we in our living rooms are watching people in their living rooms on sitcoms. And the Jetsons was very much like that. We went to the office. We went to their house. It was very sitcomic, even though those houses were up in the sky. By the way, good question as to why they had to get up there. That may be another environmental disaster that would have come in the backstory in the second season that ever happened.
See, isn't that funny? I think the Jetsons creators envisioned a future in which they could do whatever they wanted because they weren't thinking about climate change and the impacts of energy. But in retrospect, yeah, the reason they went into the sky was probably because of that exact reason. It's a good insight, Bob. Different Bob writes to say, Evan, I think your guest Roger is spot on self-driving cars. The real revolution in self-driving cars will come when a standard is established and cars talk to each other. Imagine a chain of cars moving along the interstate at 90 miles per hour, just 3 feet apart. Your car is communicating with the car in front of you, and so on and so on. And maybe a quarter of a mile ahead, half a mile ahead, cars are communicating. When someone wants to merge, a gap is opened by slowing the chain. And when someone gets off, the gap is closed off. When you get to your destination, you have the freedom traveling in your own vehicle. This would be so American, Bob says. So, Roger, is that kind of what the next step of self-driving car technology looks like? I ask that because I think that's probably achievable technologically, but we also have a very litigious society. And what we've already seen with whether it's Tesla or others is that when there's one malfunction and one person dies or is maimed, you know, I'm not blaming a grieving family, but the idea is let's take them for all they're worth. If I were driving, mm-hmm. if I were in charge, I wouldn't have made that mistake, even though we are worse drivers than the computers are. So what does that future look like, Roger?
Right. I think that eventually what's going to happen is that the people who calculate risk for insurance companies will get into this and begin to exercise some degree of discretion over how these cars, these self-driving cars that are now connected together, can behave as a unit and what the liabilities are, et cetera. I think that's going to become a need that will be satisfied at some point. It'll evolve over time. Right now, we are still basing everything on our horse and carriage and our basic automobile with ambulance chasers that are going after people saying, you know, let's get them for all they're worth. That's where we are as a society right now. I think in the longer term, people will recognize, you know, well, gee, there's some benefit here, there's some risk, and this is what you have to pay to protect yourself against that risk in order to be able to use this technology. I can see that for full self-driving of a car within a city, you know, mm-hmm. where it has to make a right turn on a red light and there are pedestrians in the crosswalk and, you know, somebody's running a red light. You know, the car has to really make an assessment of the entire immediate situation. There's a lot of situational awareness here, and then it has to make its decision and make the best decision possible. And there's going to be risk with that. So I think it's going to have to evolve as a part of the fabric of society over time. Because people will realize that, gee, there's a benefit by creating this caravan that Bob, the person that called in, talked about, a caravan of self-driving cars that are communicating with each other 3 feet apart at 90 miles an hour. That's kind of like a train car traveling from point A to point B, from city A to city B. And maybe you don't need a set of tracks. Maybe you don't need that large, you know, locomotive to carry these people from point A to point B. They can simply hook up as a caravan, proceed down the highway, and deliver this number of people to their destination in a way that's very safe and minimizes the traffic issues. So there's a lot of benefit that I think can be derived from all of these things if we put our minds to the task and recognize that it's going to take time to evolve through that.
Well, this week, Tesla had its annual shareholder meeting, and Michael Balaban is CNN's transportation editor. He was there. He reported that one of the audience members, in asking a question, told the Tesla team, quote, "I became a Marine to protect your base on Mars." So that's where the future is going. The future Mars base. Who knows? I don't know. I don't know if Elon Musk is the future entirely. He'll probably have enough money to try to have a say in that. And as we get ready to wrap here, I just want to mention that, you know, Timmy says, don't forget to mention Futurama in your discussion. How cool would it be to have a bot pal like Bender? I don't know Futurama as much, but I'm you know, there's a lot of fans of it. And Bob Thompson, you mentioned you keep calling the Jetsons a one-season show. It was in 1962. It came back in the late 1980s. You don't seem to have as much affinity because people can find those episodes on HBO Max now, but you don't seem to have as much affinity for the later Jetsons.
Yeah, I think it had two seasons in the 1980s. Yeah, but I think that by the time we got into the 1980s, you know, the Jetsons happens, you know, a few years after Sputnik. The Apollo thing is just getting started. We're still years away from landing on the moon. So I think that 60s vision of what 100 years from now was going to be was really a fascinating and a rich and an interesting time. By the time we get to the late 1980s, so much stuff has happened with technologies, computer technology, all that kind of thing, that I think the predictive fun of the much later two seasons of the Jetsons is nowhere where it was back in 1962.
Bob Thompson is a Syracuse professor who has been really one of the very best. And Bob, it's not hyperbole when I say it's an honor to have you. And I know you only say yes because fellow Syracuse alum Megan Mack calls you. So thank you for doing it always, Bob.
It is always so much fun. Thanks.
Bob Thompson from the Newhouse School at Syracuse. And Roger Duby, experimental physicist and professor emeritus and research professor at RIT, occasional optimist and sometimes dark realist. But we'll take the optimism today, Roger.
That's great. Terrific, Evan.
Thanks, my friend. Thanks for being with us. And from the whole team at Connections, thanks to everyone for listening. Hope you have a peaceful, wonderful weekend. And we'll talk to you next week on Member Supported Public Radio.